This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 22nd of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we get a hard hat tour of New York's new Park Hyatt Hotel with designers Yabu Puchelberg.
What we wanted to distill was the feeling of being in New York and the confidence that New York is. And we started thinking about, if I lived in Midtown or Uptown, who would I be and what would my home be like?
We discuss how architecture is a tool for change with the director of Architecture for Humanity.
We know what causes disasters. We know what causes slum conditions. What responsibility and what capability does the architecture community have to addressing these problems before they reach epic proportion?
And we touch down in Tokyo to discuss some of the design news stories breaking there.
It's absolutely huge. It's right in the middle of the city in a very sensitive green area, and you know there aren't many of those in Tokyo, so the latest is that Zaha Hadid has redesigned the stadium.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. In Manhattan, the final touches are currently being added to the city's new five-star hotel, Park Hyatt, New York. Located in the heart of Midtown, the hotel occupies the lower levels of the new 157 condo tower, one of Manhattan's tallest residential buildings. Opening in August, the hotel has been built to be the flagship of the Park Hyatt brand. The hotel's interiors were designed by Yabu Puchelberg. The designers themselves, George Yabu and Glenn Puchelberg, invited Monocle's Marcus Hippie for a guided tour in this hotel that's just about to open. Glenn Puchelberg started by explaining what their initial vision was.
You know, everybody talks about contextualism in hotels, and it's a bit of a nugget. It's so easy to be trite and obvious about things. And, you know, let's draw a skyline of Manhattan because we're in New York. But what we wanted to distill was the feeling of being in New York and the confidence that New York is. And we started thinking about, if I lived in Midtown or Uptown, who would I be and what would my home be like? And New Yorkers have self-confidence. They know their sense of style and chicness. What we're trying to do here is kind of create that feeling that this belongs in New York. It's a New York hotel. It's not like some generic hotel that's been kerplunked in or somebody from the outside's view of what New York is.
Because I also think it has to appeal to New Yorkers as well, this hotel. You know, it's a social center. It's a place they're going to do business. They're going to place to whatever they want to do, assignations, whatever. It's not designed just purely for out-of-town visitors.
We think the key to any successful hotel, that it is a social center that makes it dynamic and interesting. Yeah. And so you do have to attract not only the ones that are staying, visiting here, but the ones that live here or the ones that drive into New York or whatever. We also think that we go back to our earlier time when we first came to New York. It was about the mixing of people, of young and old and rich and artistic, etc. Yeah. And we wanted to, you know, in our own way, just framing it through design, at least facilitate that notion. Whether it's executed in the other areas and it actually happens, that's to be seen. But, I mean, even in this, the area that we're in right now, which is the lobby lounge, for lack of a better word, you know, we purposely made a step down to the street so that the bar becomes the stage set and that there is a circular route to travel around, which is to watch people and to be watched and to create corners and things. We think about years ago, we were in the Plaza Athénée in Paris, and it was during Fashion Week. You watch all the fashion models and the biker boyfriends and politicians from America and models, etc. And this mix of people in this hallway waiting to get into the bar. Much more interesting.
Well, Glenn and George, you've promised to show me around and actually take me on a tour and show me some of your favorite corners over here. So shall we continue and check the restaurant area next?
Very challenging space, first of all, when we came here. But it made sense that this part of the building on this floor was the dining room, so to speak. And the challenging part of it was these very two large structural columns. that sort of dominated the room. So this dining room, it naturally splits into three spaces, the center one being the largest one, the major one, and then two smaller ones off each end.
And how do you take advantage of that?
I would say use that constraint as less of a liability and use it as a sort of like discrete power restaurant where you have little different nooks and crannies.
It, we're up in space and it has light at both ends. You'll see little glimpses of outside. You'll see the New York view, which is another building. We're creating corners of rounds. Those are always the best seats in the corners, and the power table at the back for meetings. And then you need to find the little nook for the mistress table.
So when you're looking for, you're meeting someone here, you can catch someone's eye through the mirrors against the walls. But normally in a lot of traditional, let's say, European bistros, those mirrors are at the sitting height. But intentionally, we put them at standing height, a little bit in between, actually. So it's a little bit more discreet. When you're down, you can sort of hide. And that was the idea of that. So these subtle thoughts or details, I think it was a series of that that makes the room interesting. It's not a big statement, you know, like big Shark Tank in the room or something like that.
Well, Hyatt said to us they want this to be a grill restaurant, and we thought, well, to us that means it's something a little bit more masculine. It is distilled to the point that it does have that kind of powerful feeling that it should have.
I think it's interesting that you keep on repeating the word power and powerful when we're talking about this hotel.
We're in New York City, aren't we? Maybe that's the wrong adjective, but we are in New York. I think maybe the other adjective is self-confidence, which I think New Yorkers have in spades.
Shall we continue? Yeah. Where do we go next?
Let's go to the meeting ballroom level. We're entering the Onyx Room. The Onyx Room is a cube. We purposely worked with the architecture to make a hat box as the event space. Three walls are glowing onyx panels, and then the fourth wall is the New York view to the light.
The ballroom is the most challenging room to design. It has to be so multi-purpose. The programming always seems generic because it has to appeal to a wedding, to a conference, to bar mitzvah, and it's always challenging to make a statement. But we thought, you know, forget about all that criteria and throw it all out in the trash bin and think, what's going to make a great event, regardless of whether it's institutional or something celebratory?
Let's make the best room in New York for the best wedding or the best whatever.
Well, I can tell you this is definitely one of the most stunning spaces I've seen in New York this far.
Thank you. It's not the biggest room, it's the best room.
And now it's finally time to see one of the rooms. So what do we have over here?
When you come in a typical hotel, you open the door and you have this L-shaped space. You have this corridor.
You don't actually know what to expect when you enter the room because you don't see much.
Exactly. And this way, we're sort of not sure when you come in where you're going to go. Just like being invited to someone's home, you see a traveler trunk, which is actually your mini bar. Yes. I'm sorry, a mini bar to a wardrobe unit for your slippers and your safe, which all the necessary requirements one would need are hidden away. The notion of travel was just a little tongue-in-cheek thing.
And then the actual room space. What is striking is massive windows and a lot of space.
They're almost like small suites, and the bedroom is somewhat divided from a sitting area at the window or a working area.
What's interesting is that, as you already mentioned, when you are, well, outside of the rooms, there aren't that many massive, massive open spaces. But actually, once you enter the room, what I was looking over here is the shower space, which is probably the biggest I've seen for years. You can have private parties just in the shower.
If so inclined. The entrance to the bathroom is a set of double doors that slide back so that you have natural light coming into the bathroom, which people want today.
And then walking through the room to the windows, one whole wall of just windows.
It feels like a veranda off your main living sleeping space, which is kind of nice. Unexpected in New York, I think.
And we finish today's tour where actually guests start their stay in this hotel, so the entry lounge. What is the feeling you wanted to give to the customers when they enter this building for the first time?
I think that when a person steps through past the threshold into the ground floor lobby, there's a sense of you've entered someplace special. It's a relatively intimate space with a kind of grand stair that goes up to the ballroom level, finely detailed and beautifully executed.
And as we can hear in the background, there's some work to be done. So what is it like for you and George before this hotel opens? What are you busy with?
You know, it's in every project as designers, you always look for perfection, which perfection never exists. Looking around you, trying to understand, yes, not only what looks good, but what things can be tweaked, modified, even made better.
You're still designing even 3 years after opening day. So I call it the decade design. You're never, ever finished.
And it's a bit of a tricky business because you really have to project into the future of where you believe the zeitgeist of taste, style, design is going.
How can you know that?
You can't. Yeah. You have to design from your soul and not from ripping pages out of a magazine to start with.
Glenn Pushelberg and George Yabu of Yabu Pushelberg talking to our acting New York bureau chief, Marcus Hippie, on a hard hat tour of the Park Hyatt, just about to open. You're listening to Section D. Architecture is often held up as a tool for change, a method of intervention through design, and design that's deemed to help solve social ills. Recently, that idea has grown in popularity, whether it's housing design in developing nations dealing with mass urbanisation, or indeed areas predisposed to structural crisis. Architecture for Humanity is an organisation at the forefront of this movement, and it turns 15 this year. Aled John caught up with a new executive director, longtime volunteer for the company, Eric Kessel, to find out how he thinks architecture can solve at least some of the world's issues.
Let's pick up from your appointment. Where do you see yourself taking the company?
I think we're going to be focused for the next 15 years on two principal directions, which we consider expansions to our existing mission rather than an abrupt change in direction. As we looked back on the 15 years of the organization and all that we had accomplished, we asked some hard questions about what the future of the organization would hold and where we could really create value and benefit to the world on an ongoing basis. Two things really stood out. One, as we look back on our portfolio of work and humanitarian design in general, it struck us that a lot of these efforts are fundamentally reactive. The design community waits for a disaster to happen and then goes in and focuses their energy on rebuilding efforts and using design and architecture as a method to remedy something that went seriously wrong. And likewise, with low-income communities, slum communities, etc., it always appears like we're waiting for something bad to happen before we go in and address it. So we'd like the organization to move into a different frame of mind where we're proactive instead of reactive. We know what causes disasters. We know what causes slum conditions. What responsibility and what capability does the architecture community have to addressing these problems before they reach epic proportions? The other major change in direction that we contemplated was using the benefit of our experience to help a lot of the nascent public interest design firms that are sprouting up all over the world. What's really different between today and when we started Architecture for Humanity 15 years ago is that it's a common thread now. There are a multitude of organizations that are out there concerned about humanitarian and public interest issues and want to be involved in the use of architecture as a means to solve social problems. We feel that we can create a lot of value by open sourcing our history and our methodologies and sharing those with all these groups that are trying to do all this great work.
Eric, looking at specifically then the detail of the work that Architecture for Humanity does, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's turning 15 this year. You are the new appointee as executive director of the company. For those who aren't familiar, can you outline now exactly how Architecture for Humanity worked? Is it an organization that specifically depends on its own workers, or as you just suggested, are you going to begin outsourcing to third parties, which then can help you given the crisis situation that you may be trying to coordinate?
Architecture for Humanity works in several models. We have a core organization that has 6 regional offices around the world. We also have a chapter network with chapters in 59 cities around the world. Most of the work done by Architecture for Humanity is volunteer-driven. So we have a fellowship program which draws in stipended volunteers. We have volunteers through our chapter network that are also working on issues and problems. The core organization gets involved when programs are large and urgent and need higher levels of coordination. So that would be major disasters or multi-country or multi-year programs, that sort of thing. So we work with an extensive network of partners as well and allied organizations like the American Institute of Architects. So we have quite a reach in terms of how we work and how we support others that work.
As you say, there is more of a kind of a fashion now for designers and architects to be concerned with let's call it, a variety of issues surrounding housing, regeneration, urban design, how people can live better, rather than avoiding those very important issues. Do you see Architecture for Humanity kind of perhaps spreading themselves a little bit thin with its new targets, i.e. the target that you have there to be proactive rather than reactive? It's an incredibly positive thing to say, but in reality it's going to be very difficult to lay down foundations that will prevent various crises around the whole world.
Well, that's why the two pieces of the renewed vision fit together. Yes, Architecture for Humanity would spread itself incredibly thin if it were trying to solve every problem. But if we can take the 5,000 humanitarian design groups that have been created in the last 15 years and give them some of our capacity and teach them to do what we figured out and share with them all of our successes and, frankly, all of our mistakes, then we can augment the power of design on a global scale. So Architecture for Humanity can't do this alone, but we don't have to. There's designers all over the world that want to be involved in this work, and we feel that by lending them our experience and our assistance, we can multiply the impact that our organization has.
Let's look at that impact then now, if we can, in a bit more detail. What would you say Architecture for Humanity's successes and indeed failures have been over the last 15 years?
I think the principal success is starting a conversation. You know, public interest design is something that fell seriously out of fashion in the 1960s and early 1970s, and it was something that the profession ignored quite a bit up until the late 90s. And I think over 15 years, you know, our founders were some of the principal agents in driving a global renewal of this conversation and asking architects to take a look at these social problems that are cropping up all around us. So, I mean, fashion is a terrible word, but in many ways, I think Architecture for Humanity played a large role in bringing this back into fashion and bringing this back in the conversation. So I think in rough numbers, there's about 2 million people worldwide that now live and work and play in facilities designed and built by Architecture for Humanity. But the impact of that, I guess in my opinion, is shadowed by the impact of starting this conversation and helping those other agents and other organizations who have also been working over the last 15 years to bring these issues to the forefront.
What is top of the agenda then for Architecture for Humanity? You mentioned there 15 years from now. I'm not sure if you yourself will hope to be in the position for 15 years, but take the first 5 years, for instance. In terms of geography, which cities or spaces that you think are liable for disaster at some point, where is the focus for your organization?
Well, we don't have a geographic focus necessarily. You know, we have 59 chapters around the world, so we have our eyes on everywhere. I would say it's certainly possible to look at certain cities and say, you know, these cities are more at risk than those cities. And that's principally driven by, you know, rates of urbanization and vulnerability to climate change. I think that the climate change discussion has also evolved to the point where we can't ignore it anymore. And we look at something like Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines and we say, well, you know, that's going to keep happening. And it may happen in Indonesia next time or Thailand, but that's going to keep happening. And, you know, how do we identify communities that are low-lying, that lack the infrastructure to respond to particular disasters, whether natural or economic or what have you? So I think that we will be increasingly focused at an urban level, but not on a particular corner of the globe.
That was Architecture for Humanity's new executive director, Arik Kessel, in conversation with Alad John. Coming up after this short break, we see if a new web domain will help the architecture community or hinder it.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig, supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, here on Monocle 24. Being an architect is a goal of years of study and practical experience. Each nation has a respective accreditation and hoop to jump through before you gain that crucial acknowledgement, the registration to be part of the club. This year, the men behind the Starting Dot company, which develops identifiable domain names for brands, thought that architecture was one area that could do with more of a collegiate online presence. Founders Guillaume Buffet and Gudfroy Jordan created the Architects Web extension, .archi. Monocle's Sarah Fournier met Guillaume in Paris to ask him why he came up with this innovative idea.
So what do you think .archi represents?
Of course, it means architecture or architect. To be honest, we, at the very beginning, we are a French company, even if we are international right now. And in France, people don't say architect, they say archi or archi. So the idea to have an internet extension called archi came very naturally for us. The idea is to help everybody worldwide to find an architect online with an obvious internet address, which is .archi.
But the point of difference for this new extension is its exclusivity.
We have decided to restrict .archi to architects and only to architects.
Restricting access for .archi to only architects has been a major challenge for Guillaume Buffet and his team. Partnering directly with associations of architects has proven to be the solution for this hurdle.
This was quite an issue, of course, at the very beginning, and it is there that the International Union of Architects, which is a worldwide organization with 135 members, which are the national organization, for instance, RIBE, the Ordre des Architectes in France, or AIA in the USA, all these organizations are member of this International Union of Architects. To be an architect, you have to be member of an order which is a member of the International Union of Architects. So even if the diploma is not the same on various countries, as soon as you are a member of your national organization, you are considered as an architect. So it's quite simple to check if you can have a .archi or not.
Guillaume Buffet believes .archi creates accessibility, bringing together the worldwide community of architecture, firms and schools. Validation of .archi's efficacy came from an unexpected fan. 72-year-old world-renowned architect Paul Andreu, who has been fond of the project from the start.
I met him a few months ago because he wanted to be the guy who promotes .archi. It seems that Paul Andreu was fascinated by .archi, even if he's, if I remember, 72. That means that you don't need to be a geek or a digital native to understand what it is. So Paul Andreu came to me and he told me .archi is the symbol of Architects Brotherhood worldwide. It was an emotion for me when he told me that, you know, honestly, because I would have never found this sentence. And it's, I think, the best way to explain what is .archi. We would love to make it a kind of a label of the brotherhood, but of the quality of architecture, of the involvement of architects. You know, when you are an architect, you have to sign the plans you provide for a house or something. And your signature is a tremendous involvement. And we'd love to make .archi the symbol of this signature, of this involvement.
I was fascinated by the idea of someone definitely not from the web generation being so passionate about a project like .archi. I called Paul Andreu in his studio of the 11th arrondissement of Paris to ask him about this new interest of his.
Allô?
Bonjour, Monsieur Andreu, Sarah Fournier, l'appareil de Monocle.
Oui, bonjour.
Merci de prendre le temps de faire cette interview.
Can you tell me why you're on board with .archi? Why do you think it's good?
It marks a kind of solidarity between the architects, you know. Personally, I know a lot of architects in foreign countries, and sometimes I don't go to visit them very often. And I mean, about all these architects have the same type of address and can communicate when you receive a mail from them and see .archi. It's just nice for me. It's just a kind of a sign of friendship.
For Paul Andreu, .archi will create an online hub for architects, allowing them a forum to share the common passion as well as their struggles. Do you think it's going to bring the architect community together? Do you think it's useful for the architect community?
I mean, it's about that. I mean, we have a kind of same business, same difficulties, same pleasures, same hopes, and that builds a kind of brotherhood between us. And so that's just a sign that we're a gang of brothers.
Architects from over 100 countries have already signed up with .archi, kickstarting this new online community for architects. From Monocle in Paris, I'm Sarah Fournier.
Thanks, Sarah. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, every year, the Royal Institute of British Architects awards its Stirling Prize to the architects of a building that has advanced the sector more than any other. The shortlist for the 2014 selection has been released and includes Birmingham City Library, the London Aquatic Centre of Olympics fame, and among many others, the Shard in central London. To discuss the shortlist and the other buildings pushing the boundaries in architecture, not least in the British capital, I was joined by Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield and Peter Rees, Professor of Places and City Planning at University College London and former Chief Planning Officer of the City of London.
The Shard is the one that really stands out on this list, and we've been arguing about this within the office about whether the Shard is a good building or a bad building, I think pretty much since it first was mooted. Where do you stand on the Shard?
Lovely object in the wrong place. Beautiful thing to look at, not necessary for anything because there are three different uses joined together to produce enough space to be accommodated within this giant structure. And it's attempting to make London Bridge something it isn't, a centre of attraction.
London Bridge is not a centre of attraction.
It's a sign of a giant inferiority complex. The good thing is it tells you when you're nearly in the city.
Okay, that is true. I mean, Tom Morris, this is, to repeat an argument we've been having off air, this building is pretty much everything that is wrong with modern day capitalism, isn't it? It's completely ruined the city.
I wouldn't say it's ruined the city at all. I think what it stands for, and obviously the investment behind it, where the money's come from, it's an icon of this capitalist push in the city. But I don't know, I'm a huge fan of it. And I actually disagree with you, Peter. I like the fact that it sort of stands alone. I think it's the most kind of handsome. When it first went up, I had huge reservations about it. But actually, the longer it's been there, and you know, you walk along the South Bank or cross a bridge in the evening, the way the sort of the light bounces off of it, I find it just incredibly striking. And I do find that whether you like it or not, I think, you know, skylines should say something of the history of a city. And I think we look back in 30 years, it will be a strange trace of a very strange time in London's history.
I didn't say I didn't actually like it. It's strange. What I said was it wasn't necessary. But now that we've got it, it is a beautiful object. Over 10% of it is completely useless at the top. It's pure architecture. And it's interesting, as buildings get tall around the world, the percentage of the building that's unused and is purely architectural expression at the top increases. Mm. But it is a beautiful object, I accept that, and I think it has become a worthwhile thing on the London skyline. One of the things that worries me most, though, is that it spawned an awful lot of tall buildings across London, which are not, as the Shard is partially useless. The buildings that are going up now are totally useless. They're piles of safety deposit boxes for offshore investment.
And far less beautiful.
Indeed. Whereas the trend we tried to start in the City of London years ago was to only build tall because we'd run out of space. Mm. So the cluster of towers around the Gherkin are there purely to provide the office floor space that people work in, and only because we'd run out of land to build what we call ground scrapers.
Mm-hmm. One undeniably beautiful building in London that's on this list is the Aquatic Centre by Zaha Hadid, which was obviously, we all saw 2 years ago during the Olympics, Tom, but that's when it had its water wings. They've been taken down. It's now a very lovely swimming pool.
Yeah, and that's one thing that's so interesting. It's in the list now because it was quite well commented on the fact that it wasn't in the lineup 2 years ago. And now, you know, all these six buildings on the list, they do all sort of have one combining trait, and that's they are sort of buildings for communities. And now that it's become a public swimming pool where people can use, and it's not just for athletes and sort of showing off to the world what London is and how much money London's got and what we can do for the Olympics, it's now a functioning civic building. And I think that's why it's interesting it's on the list now.
And that's interesting, Peter, Tom's point there about many of these buildings being buildings for the community. There's the wonderful new library in Birmingham, which is, it's funny, I was there about 5 or 6 weeks ago on a Saturday, and it was absolutely packed with ordinary Brummies in a way that a museum or an art gallery is often built to attract tourists and outsiders. This was a library built for the people that live there.
Indeed, they are all buildings to some extent for the public, and they're all buildings which in some ways are theatrical. The Shard is obviously theatrical, and you pay as much as you'd pay for a theatre seat in Liverpool to go up and just look at the view at the top. But it is a performance. very much the act of going to the building and either going to one of the restaurants or going up to the viewing gallery at the top. The Aquatic Centre is as much about performance as it is about the athletes that are training there. It's about watching as well. And the theatre and the library and the School of Art. It's the School of Art again, you know, I mean, art students love to pose, and what a wonderful space in which to pose and be pretentious. And then, of course, the student union at the LSE, you know, what a fantastic place to get completely wasted. It's, with those sloping walls, they won't know whether they're upright or not.
Tom, what does this list tell you about the state of architecture in Britain at the moment?
Well, I think there's a huge variety. I mean, you know, half the buildings on the list are in London, half of them aren't, which is nice to see. In terms of, you know, a unifying aesthetic style, there isn't one. You can't really get any sense of, you can't test the waters to see what's going on in architecture at the moment stylistically, apart from, I was talking to Peter before, you know, there's a certain decorativeness to a couple of the buildings, particularly the one in Birmingham, that's, you know, quite interesting. But it's quite difficult to sort of come out with any conclusion about the state of architecture or the style of current architecture.
And Peter, is there anything that you feel is missing from this list that you would have liked to have seen highlighted?
I'm always concerned that the projects that make the shortlists for these prizes are the big glitzy schemes by the star architects. I remember judging a competition in Scotland for architectural awards a few years ago. As the chairman, I was allowed to choose a project to give an award to. And I chose a little community garden in Glasgow in a derelict area where the local community had put something together in a place that on the face of it had no hope at all. There's always something you can do to make a place better. Sadly, the smaller schemes tend not to rise to the surface in these sort of competitions. But then, you know, this is a competition for star architects, we have to admit it. And some of them, I think, are very practical. I'm putting my money on the Manchester School of Art because it's honest use of materials, it's sustainable because it's reusing an existing building, and it's going to have life in it, and it's going to get knocked about by the students. Mm. It's not a precious building.
Tom Morris, if you had to choose one that you'd like to see take away the prize?
Well, I know it'd be boring to agree with Peter, but I do. But I think it's a great building. It's beautiful. It's an amazing sort of reuse of an old structure, and it's clever and it's modest, but I doubt it will win.
What do we think will win then?
I suspect it's going to be a Zaha or a Renzo.
Or I think possibly the Birmingham Library, which I think would be my second choice. I think it's a lovely... lyrical about it as well.
I'm a big fan of the library, even if it did take 10 years for them to finally build it. And actually, I really liked the old Central Library in Birmingham, which is an absolute design monstrosity, but was right in the heart of town. So people, it wasn't a destination. People walked through it. They went past it on the way to somewhere else, which I think a library should be. This one's a bit more of a destination, but still very beautiful. And I hope it wins.
And shouldn't we just say what a wonderful... indication of the health of British architecture to see such marvellous schemes
absolutely,
on the list.
Absolutely, exactly. That was Monocle Steve Bloomfield and Peter Rees of University College London there, talking with me. Coming up, our Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson will run us through the big stories in Japan this week, and the author of a new book on typography tells Aled John where he found his new fonts. Take a look at the clouds above, the fuel lines in the sky, or the scaffolding in a building site, and it won't take long before you make out the letters of the alphabet. Typography is as omnipresent a form of design as you can get, and it's this scavenger hunt for font through natural and man-made creations that Stephen Heller and Gail Anderson explored in their new book, The Typographic Universe. Steve spoke to Aled John before we came to air.
The Typographic Universe is a new book by you and Gail Anderson. The subtext is letter forms found in nature, the built world, and human imagination. Why do this book?
That's why is the sky blue? We did this book because the sky is blue, and it's full of typography. You look up in the sky, and you see clouds forming letters. You see buildings forming negative space of letters. There are letters everywhere around us, and once you start looking for them, it just becomes so apparent and so wonderful that you want to save them in some way. So we got many different designers who were doing the same thing and put them together in one book.
So it's a collaborative effort between you, Gail, and a series of designers. Is it a book for designers, or does the man on the street, will he or she be able to enjoy some of the discoveries in the book?
I think because there's a puzzle quality to it, anybody could enjoy it. And now that the man in the street and the woman in the street are aware of type because of the computer, they're certainly aware of fonts, this may be revelatory for them, and it may be a lot of fun to kind of pick these things out of the environment.
Type is kind of coming into its own in, I guess, the popular consciousness to an extent. There's a huge exhibition recently in New York dedicated to the different types of type used over the years. It was sort of co-partnered by Pentagram. Why do you think there is a greater interest now in kind of chronicling the many different types of type and indeed font and how that is changing?
Well, I think people are aware of what they're reading on screen. And I think that because they're reading it and they can change it at will, they've become aware that type has a kind of personality. And sometimes that personality echoes their own personality. And they know the names of certain typefaces. Of course, they call everything fonts, and it's not exactly accurate. A typeface is a typeface, and a font is a collection of typefaces. But in general, they know what these things are, the way they know, in general, how a car works.
It's a kind of, sort of a learning by osmosis, you think, because it's so omnipresent. It's one of the types of design which is everywhere. And people, even if they don't know the names, they recognize the style at least.
Osmosis is a good way of putting it. You know, it's not that they go to school for it, they don't read a book for it, but they see it and they absorb it, and it becomes part of their consciousness.
So let's look at some of the personality kind of types that you mentioned there through the book. It's divided into chapters: objectified type, bodily type, you've got sculptural type, edible type, industrial type. Before we go on to those individual sections, was it fun for you to put this together? It's like a kid in a toy shop to an extent. You've got so many options for exploration. It's kind of overwhelming to an extent.
Well, Gail and I both had a great deal of fun. She did the majority of the research. I did the majority of the writing and ultimately interpreting what people were sending us. So, yeah, it was fun to see all the variations. And it was also fun to argue, is this really an E or an F, or what are you looking at? Because I can't see it.
Which are your favorites then, in terms of the, not just the discoveries, but the stuff that people have sent you? Let's go into the book if we can. Which section, which chapter pricks your interest more than any other?
I love edible type because I like to eat. I love type that is made from other objects. And the best ones, and I'm afraid I can't cite an individual one right now, but the best ones are those that are kind of pun-like, which is what graphic design is all about. It's about elevating the pun to a visual statement. And so the use of some of these letter forms made by flowers or made by ingredients or made by meat or made by chicken, or my favorite actually in the whole book is one made by toenail clippings, which isn't a food, but it is organic. And I love the way people see these things, put them together, make full alphabets out of them, and then sometimes use them. Sometimes these are applied alphabets, and other times they're more artistic one-offs.
There was a story we covered on Section D a couple of weeks back about a Lisbon-based design firm that had effectively taken note of all the tram lines, the wiring in the skies, effectively, above the city, and how they interconnected and turned it into a font, and it's now become the official font of Lisbon, which is quite an amazing development.
That is amazing. I wish we had it for the book. It sounds terrific.
Well, it's that kind of sort of ingenuity that I guess people will look at your book and they can then create certain types beyond that. Is there much market for that? Is there an interest in developing typefaces beyond the chronicling of it as you have done here?
When the computer first came out and Fontographer and other programs were introduced, there was a great deal of activity in making unique bespoke typefaces. A lot of them were grungy. I did a book called Faces on the Edge many years ago, which chronicled those. You know, some of them lasted, most of them did not. You know, they're hard to use as text faces. You can't read them. They're used primarily to draw attention into a poster or a headline for an article or something. But most of those faces were done because people kind of felt this is an area of art that hasn't been covered yet, and maybe we can find some way of making it unique.
One final question then, Stephen. If we were to talk about a type of artistic font that was unique, that was your favorite, say, from a Word document, what would it be?
Yeah, well, I have to say that I go to the default of Arial. It's not that I like the face, it's just easier for me to write with. I can't write with serif faces, and Arial is a sans serif face.
Stephen Heller, co-author of The Typographic Universe, talked to Aled there.
Grundig believes that television should provide more than entertainment. They should connect you with your world. Its state-of-the-art smart LED TVs allow you to unite with friends via Skype, watch over a sleeping child next door with Babycam, or control access to the internet through your mobile phone. Grundig is committed to investing in the best technology, digital innovation, and superlative design to help you bond with the world from your own home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Let's close the show with a look at some of the big design stories making waves in Japan. Our Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson, joins us now. Welcome to the show, Fiona.
Hello there.
So let's start with slightly old news, but a very important story coming out of Tokyo, which is Zaha Hadid's redesign of the controversial Olympic Stadium.
Well, this has been quite an ongoing story this year. I mean, a bit of backstory, Zaha Hadid's winning design, when they actually sat down to price it up, it was going to cost about $3 billion to build. It was twice the budget they were planning on in Japan. It's an 80,000-seater stadium. It's absolutely huge. It's right in the middle of the city in a very sensitive green area. And, you know, there aren't many of those in Tokyo. So it's just caused the biggest rumpus. Lots of architects have come out against it, and not just people trying to make a name for themselves. I mean, you're talking Fumiko Maki, Toyo Ito, So Fujimoto, really big names, saying this is the wrong building for this location. And there's been a very big campaign to try and stop the old National Stadium being demolished. Mm. It hasn't been demolished yet, but it is set to be demolished any minute now. So the latest is that Zaha Hadid, who's been very quiet in the face of all this criticism, has redesigned the stadium.
And is this a redesign for financial reasons, because the first one was too expensive, or a stylistic problem?
I mean, it's a bit of both, to be honest, because obviously the budget was just out of control. Everyone said, you know, $3 billion stadium, Tokyo doesn't need that. It was scaled back. The budget is now half that. It's a more reasonable, but I would still say pretty extravagant budget. The design, I've looked at the redesign, very difficult to see where the redesign has come. The big problem with it, which is that it just looks like an enormous spaceship that's been dropped in the middle of Tokyo. That problem remains. It's absolutely vast on a site that just isn't big enough for it. So they can't solve that problem. The sort of current feeling is, why don't we renovate the existing National Stadium, which is very successful, very well loved, has no problems with turf, none of this business about retractable roofs. It's just a very simple stadium. And I think a lot of people felt that Japan's Olympic bid in 2020 was about sustainability. And this new building is sort of the opposite of that. In spite of the fact that the architects came out quite strongly saying, I mean, they did use architect speak, which I think actually repels more people than it attracts, but they described it as being more user-focused, adaptable, sustainable. You know, hard to see how such a massive building can be that sustainable. And I just think the problem with it remains, it's too big for the location, and it's really upsetting a lot of people in a bit of Tokyo that's a rather nice green open area at the moment.
And it's upset the industry, but what's the sort of feeling from the common man in Tokyo? What's their take on the look of it?
Well, a lot of people have spoken out against it. Thousands of people signed a petition that Toyo Ito had going. Hundreds of people turned out the other weekend. You know, it's roused a lot of popular anger, I would say. I don't know if Zaha Hadid's office is aware of this, but people feel very strongly about it. I mean, I think protecting Tokyo's few green spaces is very important. And it's hard to find anybody. In fact, I don't know anybody who supports this project. So I think it's quite a tricky one for such a famous architect. And she did talk about initially when the design was announced, you know, about how much it suited the context and how much she liked Japan. And I think it's really just upset people. And most people feel it doesn't have anything to do with the context. So I think it's made people question these vast projects all round. And that may not be a bad thing. I think that, you know, general feeling is that these particularly the Olympics has become a bit of a sort of, you know, it's a bit bloated in terms of construction, and Japan has got a diminishing population. Does it really need an 80,000-seater stadium? And I think they just look across to what's happened to the bird's nest in Beijing. Mm. It's empty for most of the year. It's not used. It's a white elephant, never mind a bird's nest. Is this what Tokyo really needs? It doesn't fit the location. You know, I realise I'm being quite negative about it, but I think that is the reality of this project. It's not quite right for Tokyo.
And talking of the Olympics, there's another great building in Tokyo which will also be demolished by that point, which is the Hotel Okura, which if anyone's read our July-August issue will see Monocle's launched our very own little campaign to save it. Tell us a few more details about that.
Well, I mean, this is a real Tokyo classic. I never thought I'd see the day when it would be demolished. I was afraid it would be demolished, but I never thought it would happen. It was built in 1962 ahead of the 64 Olympics. And it's an absolute classic. It was designed by such an interesting group of architects, including Yoshiro Taniguchi, who's been responsible for some great buildings in Tokyo. And it's a sort of time warp in a way. It's got a very old-fashioned feeling. The interior of the lobby, the public areas, is exactly as it was in 1962, a few very minimal changes. The rooms have been changed, but the public areas are just as they were. The feeling is absolutely unique. You couldn't be anywhere but Tokyo. If you tried to recreate it, you couldn't. It's a sort of the alchemy of a great hotel, which is a mixture of location, people, experience, its architecture, all rolled into one. And the developers have decided it's time to demolish it and put up a big glass tower. And, you know, it's very, very upsetting for a lot of people. And it's interesting how much publicity or how much interest this campaign that we've started has generated. I've had so many emails from people who, from all over the world, who've stayed there, who feel very strongly, can't believe that Tokyo would allow this to happen. And yeah, it's a very sad time, I think.
And Japanese culture revolves around this idea of scrap and build, which we've discussed before. Do you think, you know, and it is part of this, the city of Tokyo being ever-changing and, you know, buildings going up and coming down, and that's kind of leads to a certain dynamism there, which you don't get in any other city. Do you think this is fatal? Do you think the Okura is doomed?
I think it would be very hard to stop that project. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's a dynamism here about construction. There's a lack of sentimentality. It's a really fascinating side of this city. And I, you know, I don't object to new architecture at all. Obviously, you know, I'm writing about it a lot and have done for many years. I think, you know, there's a time and a place. This is one building that absolutely should not be demolished. It says something so remarkable about Japan. And it records a very interesting moment in Japan when Japan was coming out after the war. It was showing its face to the world. This is the new modern Japan, and it's captured. You just can walk in there and you be taken back in time. But it's not just a time warp. It's an incredibly successful, you could go to a great restaurant, a great bar, have a really good experience. It's not just a sort of retro curiosity. It's a living hotel. It's got so much going for it. And you just wonder what will happen when they demolish it. You can't recreate that. And, you know, there are so many examples. We talk about that in Monocle, of buildings that have been demolished. And, you know, they do leave a strange kind of scar on Tokyo, that these missing buildings, there's an absence for anyone who knows Tokyo and loves it. And I think this will be one of the really sad ones. And it is, so many people have been telling me the same thing.
Yeah, it's such a great loss. It's a beautiful place. But let's get on to some more positive news, which is the Art Directors Club of Japan and their annual Advertising Design Awards, which happened recently.
Yes, I mean, this is an exhibition. It's ongoing, actually. People can still go and see this. It's at a couple of locations. The Art Directors Club of Japan, it's been going since the 50s. It's where all the sort of big art directors are members. There are 80 members. And they dish out these awards every year for the best advertising and design. It's just a really interesting snapshot of what's going on in Japanese advertising and design at this particular moment. And I think it's a very interesting exhibition for anyone from outside Japan, to be honest, because if you're not watching Japanese television, you might not see all these adverts. It's a mixture of commercials, some products, posters. If actually the Grand Prix winner is it's a poster campaign for, it's called Hiroshima Appeals. They do one every year. They've done them for the last 16 years. It's an appeal for world peace, which is something Hiroshima has been doing for a long time. And the winner of this year's award is Kaoru Kasai. He's a bit of a veteran, actually. He's a very interesting designer. He's done so many campaigns over the years, United Arrows, Suntory. And this is a really simple poster, very simple line drawing. It's very clear. And I think it's a really lovely reduced, it's a bit of art, actually. I mean, it's a brilliant bit of graphic art.
And then there's Toyota as well, wasn't it, that won with a bit more of a bombastic ad.
Well, that's the weird thing about, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the strange thing about these awards is that, you know, it can be coming from all different angles. So you have this very sort of serious appeal to world peace. And then you've got a Toyota ad for a couple of cars, the Hachiroku, the 86, it's a sort of retro inspired car, and the Aqua, there's sort of, I don't even know how, you have to see the ad. They're sort of duking it out to a soundtrack of Shakin' Stevens. Quite why, I'm not sure. But the art director's Club of Japan thought that was worth an award. So they got one of the top awards for that. Very, very kind of starry team involved in all these ads. There was also another project for One Cup Sake, which you can buy in convenience stores. So, you know, somebody had designed a great series of little glasses, One Cup Sake glasses. So it's a mixed bag. It's a very interesting exhibition. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. Well, cheers to that. We'll raise our One Cup Sake. Fiona Wilson in Tokyo, many thanks indeed. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you've got any thoughts or queries. I'm Tom Morris, and to play you out, after hearing all about the world of words and the typographic universe, here's I Wrote the Book by Beth Ditto. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye. You up, I treat you well, I tell you secrets I never tell. We pretend it's all okay, but there's one thing we never say. The world is full of good intentions, paradise is hard to find. Say they love you, but fail to mention who they were with again last night. I'll break you down. The world is full.